On from your left to right, I have Donald K. Slayton, Director of Flight Crew Operations, Manned Spacecraft Center. George H. Page, Apollo Mission Director. George M. Lowe, Apollo Spacecraft Program Manager, Manned Spacecraft Center. Christopher C. Kraft, Jr., Director of Flight Operations, Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. Charles A. Berry, Director of Medical Research and Operations, Manned Spacecraft Center. Major General Vincent G. Houston, Department of Defense, Manager of Manned Spaceflight Operations Support. And MP Pete Frank, Orange Team Flight Director, who handled the entry. And on the far end there, Eugene F. Krantz, White Team Flight Director. They've chosen not to make any sort of opening statements. We'll open it for questions, and please wait for the microphone. Jim Maloney.
Dr. Berry, before the launch of Apollo 9, you were talking about practicing better preventive medicine, and I wonder if you've had time to think about implementing that sort of thing.
Well, we've done a lot of thinking about it, Jim, and I can't tell you at the moment what other things that we can do. We have we developed prior to the Apollo 8 mission a fairly comprehensive plan of what we would do in a preventive way to try and cut down exposure to illnesses in that immediate pre-flight period for a period of about 21 days pre-flight. And that's an arbitrary time that was selected, and if you start looking at all the organisms involved, you could play around with those numbers, certainly. But that seems a reasonable thing. And we're just going to have to continue to look at that plan. We all feel that we need to follow it carefully and see what we can do. There are many things you just cannot do in that period, Jim, and I don't have any new innovations that I can add that are different from what we've been trying to do.
Okay, next question. Right here.
General Houston, we got a very close look at the recovery operations this time, I think about the closest ever, and they seem to have quite a bit of trouble getting the sling down. Have they always had this trouble in the recoveries?
Well, I'm not a sailor myself, but it did appear that way, but I really think it was a matter of, for the first time we saw it up so close. They didn't have any more trouble than normal, I don't believe, with the exception that, as a matter of fact, they were on the carrier in 15 minutes, or 50 minutes, which is about as good as we've ever done. It's in our best during Gemini and Apollo. It's been 45 or 50 minutes. We had ideal weather, but before the fact, Admiral McManus, who runs the task force, indicated he would have preferred a little bit of wind, because what was actually happening apparently was that the wash from the helicopter was moving the spacecraft out from under it. And if it had a little bit of wind, it would have kept, I guess they call it steerage way or something like that, against the sea anchor, and it would have remained stable. So they had a little bit of a problem in this regard. But I don't think it was a serious situation or highly abnormal, as a matter of fact.
Okay, front row here.
George Lowe. George, now that you know, you've been able to look at the data from the flight of the LEM on last Friday, can you tell us in detail what your evaluation of it is of the spacecraft, the LEM spacecraft?
You're talking about the LEM?
Okay. I got the impression from listening to the air ground, and I don't know who to ask this question of. I got the impression from reading the transcript and listening to the air ground that there were quite a few instances in this flight of little things apparently being done wrong, not going wrong mechanically, but being done wrong, the switches left unflipped or flipped erroneously and so forth. And I wonder if somebody could comment on this, because some of the other flights were very smooth in this respect.
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that. I don't think that in the first place it was any different than any other flight, Bill. I think that you've got to recognize we have very complex vehicles here, very complex communication system, particularly in this spacecraft, where we're dealing with VHF, both to the ground and between the spacecraft, S-band downlinks coming down, S-band downlinks coming, VHF downlinks, UHF command, S-band command. All those make for a very complex configuration. I think you heard a lot of that both from the ground and the spacecraft, and trying to go back to some basic configuration each time and then work on trying to get the best communications from the standpoint of data. Recognizing again that we have no tape recorder on the limb, so we're very anxious to get data at certain points in the flight when we're over the stations. The other aspect of it, I think, is the computers. These astronauts have to know a great number of things and almost have to be geniuses in how to operate both of those computers. We're watching it when we can from the ground in terms of the downlink, the digital data that we see, and we do see sometimes that they make a mistake, and that's what we hope we can catch. I'd like to point that out in terms of the SPS burn the other day. Most people got kind of excited about the fact that we came up on that burn and didn't burn, but we considered that in the mission as a non-critical burn, and had that been a critical burn such as retrofire or a maneuver for a rendezvous, the astronauts would have gone right ahead with their manual technique and made the maneuver, and I'm sure made it very successfully under computer control. But they just, in this case, we were setting up to save RCS propellant by having certain quads on and certain quads off, and the computer said, hey, you got the wrong quads on. They had not configured it properly, and therefore it stopped the burn, which it was supposed to do. But that's a mistake you could expect to be made because it was a non-nominal situation. So as far as I'm concerned, I think they did an extremely capable and competent job in the air, and I think the team on the ground did as they should have done, was to help them out.
Front row down here.
Along that same line, before the flight, McDivitt referred to the demands of the flight as a rather unwieldy, calm effort. And do you now feel that you've kind of licked that, that you've come out of this with the confidence that you can handle a lot of different solutions on the ground and in the air and the communications involved?
I think that's very true, Vic. I know that I am extremely well pleased with the combination of what the crews can do and what the ground can do and how they can transfer this flow of information back and forth. All of us, and particularly myself and George Lowe, said to you before the flight that we would be very surprised if we got everything accomplished in this mission because it was so very complex. I don't see how it could have been done any better. In that regard, as George just mentioned here, one of the main cogs in this flight control team, by the way, was another astronaut who was on the ground, and that was Stu Roosa. And his combination with our team here of flight controllers was one of the most outstanding performances I've ever seen carried out, and he had a great deal to do with what was accomplished. We can't praise him too highly.
Question for Deke Slayton. Before the flight, we heard that perhaps because of an overload of work, the astronauts' resistance might have been lowered. During the flight, we noticed things such as the length of time it took to move from the command module into the LEM. So I wonder if, based on the experience of 9, you're looking at any changes in astronaut routines or future flight plans.
Well, I think we all recognized, Roy, before we launched this one, that it was a very complex mission. So we had an awfully lot to do in those first 5 days. It was kind of 5 days of panic followed by 5 days of boredom, and there really wasn't any way to get around that one. And our resulting workload during those first days was very difficult, and we knew it was. We had, I think, on the other hand, trained adequately for it, and the one area where we were a little soft, and there really isn't any way to get around that, is the time it takes to get suited up, housekeeping, unstowed, and so forth, and get transferred into the LEM. And as you remember, we did have problems with that in the first 2 days we tried it. That's one of those things that's very difficult to simulate on the ground and get a feel for, and that's one reason you do flight tests. I think we'll have to wait until the crew gets back and get their comments on exactly what particular thing was giving them the problem. But getting back to the training workload, yes, it was very, very heavy. I think by the time we got to about T-minus 10 days, we were off the hump and everybody was relaxed. We had accomplished what we'd hoped to and got back down to an 8 to 9 hour day. But I think this is not peculiar to this mission. I think every mission, when you get from the 45 to 60 day point, no matter how far in the future you set it, there's just so many activities in there that have to take place within that time frame that there's really not much of any way around it.
Any more questions over here?
You mentioned the suiting difficulties, Deke. On the strength of this crew's experience in going back and forth without gloves and helmets, do you think there's a likelihood that that procedure will be changed as the IVT?
Well, we hope so. Harry, yes. I think we'd like to eventually get into a mode where we launch without suits and go to the moon without suits. I think there again it'll be somewhat dependent upon how these guys feel about it at this point in time. Our confidence in the LEM systems, the difficulties or lack thereof by maneuvering around without a suit on. But I think that's a decision we're not ready to make yet.
Any further questions here? Mark Bloom?
As the aft mission is currently structured, how long will it be and how much time will be spent up at the moon?
Beg your pardon?
As the aft mission is currently structured, how long a mission will it be and how much time will be spent in lunar orbit?
Let's see, the 60 hours roughly in lunar orbit as presently planned. The return time, I don't know exactly. It could be somewhere between 72 and 86 hours depending upon the time, the launch date. That would fluctuate. And also how much propellant we had remaining in the SPS at the time we left the moon. We may be able to speed that up a little bit as we did in the C-prime mission.
Okay, here comes number 5.
Any other questions? Okay, Mark.
What is the specific reason for, or the major reasons for 60 hours or 3 days actually?
We will have accomplished the rendezvous at the end of the second astronaut day at something like 40-some hours. We want to get some additional navigation information around the moon by taking sightings on some of the landing sites from which we can gain a navigational fix on how well we're able to track from the ground and how well then we would be able to update the spacecraft so that the last 10 hours around the moon will be spent in those kind of navigational studies and marks followed by the normal trans-Earth injection at about 60 hours.
Any further questions here? I have one proxy question. Excuse me, Hans. Hans Meyer back there. Wait for the mic, please. Wait for the mic.
Question to Dr. Barry. You used a new method of sleeping. They slept for the first time in space all three at the same time period. Now, what's your experience with it?
On some of that, I'll have to wait for post-flight debriefing, but it appears from what did occur in flight, as we know it at the present time, that this was a very successful thing, and the sleep period seemed to be much better on this mission than they have been on the previous two flights. And we would anticipate this with them having the opportunity to get rid of activity of the man who's awake. It seemed to work out very well.
So I'd like to comment on that. There's been some discussion that we had to relearn something in Apollo that we already knew in Gemini. And I'd just like to make it clear that our plan has always been to sleep three people. The reason we did not do it on 7 or 8 is because these were the first flights of the vehicle, and we didn't want to maintain a onboard watch of the systems. We had enough confidence in the systems after those two missions, so we felt this was unnecessary.
Mark Bloom?
Last, ask one final question. Mr. Lowe, have we finally solved the window problem? Are they okay on this mission?
From all reports so far, they were much better, at least. Mark, the crew reports, and we haven't talked to him in detail about it yet, were that the center hatch window was almost entirely clear, although they still saw a small spot at one time. And this is the one that we really concentrated on fixing. The left-hand rendezvous window, I think at times, was still slightly less than fully transparent, but that's the one we had not touched at all on the spacecraft, and the two side windows, I believe, were completely clear. So we've gone a long ways in the direction of fixing.
Up front here, Lee Holly.
Dr. Barry, I noticed on the menus that they didn't have any coffee this time, and before they have, is this a medical reason or crew preference? They just didn't want any coffee.
It was just a crew preference.
I have one proxy question here from Mary Bubb, Firechild Publications at the Cape. Would you summarize in-flight problems with the lunar module and command service module that are still being studied, open items, that is? Someone want to field that one?
Well, let me try to take a crack at it. The list isn't very long. On the Luna module, we had some problems with the supercritical helium in that the pressure decayed more rapidly than we expected during the first part of the long burn and then decayed for the remainder of the mission. This is not yet fully answered. We also had the failure of the tracking light on the lunar module. And during the ascent burn to depletion, we had one of two redundant pressure regulators that did not regulate within its limits. Those are the most significant items on the lunar module. On the command and service modules, there was a difficulty throughout the first part of the mission, at least, with the sextant part of the guidance system, in that in the manual mode of moving the sextant, it appeared to get stuck in one position several times. This seems to have cleared itself in the remainder of the flight. We also had one of three fuel cell temperatures that for 2 or 3 days operated slightly out of limits, and that too cleared itself. This is a small shuttle valve that apparently had a small particle stuck in it for several days that cleared itself. So by the time we ended the mission, I think as far as the CSM was concerned, we had a clean slate, and the LEM problems, as I said, would not detract in any way from flying the next mission, although we do want to look at the data in more detail.
Okay, the spacecraft is now on the Guadalcanal. Let's take a couple more questions. Harry Pease over here.
I wonder if you could follow up on the booster. Do you have a handle on what happened to the S-4B on the final burn? And also, can we expect that we'll have these labored long burns just because there's a heavier payload on the Saturn V now?
Let me try that, Harry. The data on the second restart of the S-4B just arrived at Marshall yesterday because it was recovered out in the Pacific, at the Pacific tracking stations. I think it would be premature at this time to speculate on what might have caused the problem that did occur with the inability to open the main engine valves. As far as your second question, I think that there will be a longer burn of the S-4B required for the TLI escape maneuver from Earth orbit, but well within the capability, the fuel capability of that stage, even with the Apollo 10 or 11 payloads, either one.
John Lanham?
For Mr. Lowe, were there any problems with the LEM windows as compared to the command?
No, none whatsoever, that we know of today, at least.
Last call for questions. Thank you very much.